This first one is an inventory by way of introduction. I wrote it about 4 years ago when I was living in a place called Leatherhead in Surrey, living out of a holdall. I was actually commuting to and from Bristol, working in the theatre Monday to Friday and then going for the weekends. This poem arose from that odd existence. It's called What to Say When You Talk to Yourself. In the corner, doubled up, black PVC, my travelling bag, my four cream walls, my single key, my wardrobe, my mirror, my coloured underwear, my sponge bag, my dirty laundry watching me, my comb, my gel and my spikes of hair, my box of matches, my sparks, my wallet and my BR Clarks, my grills, my standard class return to Paddington, my black remarks, my fondness for watching things burn, my rainy pavements, all night barnacled with yellow light, my nostalgia for the beach, my empty rooms, my long sight and my skinny boxer's reach, my arrivals, my departures, my grey wax-faced commuters on the Circle Line, my sense of waste, my animosities, my lungs, my sliding door hiccuping at Swindon, my freshly soled and laced black boots fit for pacing my bedroom floor, and one brittle rose sandwiched in the prose of Jonathan Swift, my forehead, my nose, my ears and my gift for hanging pictures well, my rigid way with words, my desserts, my tasteless ties, my love of birds with Paxo, big eyes and lips, my skew-if smile dying on my face, my dark and broken turds slipped into the water like a crocodile. Someone once told me that that summed me up perfectly, which rather worried me, I think, particularly the last bit. How they would know that, I don't know. Anyway, before I go on to the next one, I'd just like to point out about that title. I'd lifted it from a book of, the book was called What to Say When You Talk to Yourself, and the bookseller records every year the oddest titles from the Frankfurt Book Fair and others to choose from included The Theory of Lengthwise Rolling, Oral Sadism and the Vegetarian Personality, The Lesbian Sadomasochism Safety Manual, The Thermodynamics of Pizza, The Teach Your Chicken to Fly Training Manual, and Knife Throwing, a Practical Guide. I probably didn't pick the best one, but I'm not sure that the others would have actually suited the situation. I also work in the theatre as a director, and I once adapted a book about Dennis Nielsen called Killing for Company as a one-man play. I don't know if any of you know about the case of Dennis Nielsen, but he murdered 15 people in North London at the end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s, and disposed of them by cutting them up and flushing them down the toilet and various things like that. One of the things he said was, "It still surprises me how totally a man can vanish." And for some reason, that's always fascinated me, particularly living in London where there's such anonymity. Right, this poem is actually called The Body Parts Laundrette. In some way in my mind, I've fused this idea of Dennis Nielsen disposing of people with the anonymity of laundrettes. Disposing of your laundry, I suppose. It's called The Body Parts Laundrette. Four legs go in, the headboard's next. It's grey, it's cold, where a birdcage and a bed in sections furnish the space outside the Last Chance antique shop. At sundown, in the laundrette, every day, long neon strip lights twitch into life. Light spills across the pavement like a knife. Windows mist, shapes move inside, and the evenings drag. The sounds of agitation never stop. Stuffed with handbills or copies of the local rag, the letterbox is down at ankle height. Footprints lead away in all directions. The body parts laundrette is open through the night. In the window, cards and leaflets face the street like ghosts. The car boot sale that came and went. Masseurs without surnames. Radios for sale. School fates. When the ancient machinery shivers and purrs, puddles appear from cracks in the concrete floor, then seep towards strategically placed steel grates. There's a payphone, a bin, a woman's calf, and the patron saint of the body parts laundrette, Dennis Nielsen, watching from a photograph nailed to the supervisor's padlocked metal door. One laundry basket's filled with odd feet customers have left behind. It's dripping wet. The supervisor, for her sins, wears fluffy mules and a quilted dressing gown. She burnishes the hacksaws, chains and knives hung from the yellowing walls, or gathers up the ticked and folded questionnaires that quiz the customers about their empty lives. Have you used 1, an acid bought in town, 2, soap, or 3, detergent in a paper cup? Somewhere between a coma and a dream, alone, on plastic seats, they pass whole days in front of tedious machines, watching the steam, the suds, those churning reds and greys. I'm afraid that the selection I've chosen tonight involves quite a few body parts, so that's probably the worst of them. I was born and grew up in Swansea, in an all-boys school, which is still there, I think, still an all-boys school as well. Very tall, five stories high, very thin. I don't know, it's stuck in my mind. It's a very thin building, one classroom and a corridor wide and five stories up. And when I first went there, it was surrounded by marshland. I think it's still been since been developed, but at the time it was like this monolith in the middle of nowhere. The only other thing about this poem that is important is that Mr. Robbins was my English teacher. I couldn't resist slipping somebody's name in a poem. So it's called The Top Floor. Our bottled fetus has flowering limbs. I close the cupboard door on it. In his room, Mr. Robbins is folding down the thumbed corner of a page of Milton, loving the solid brickwork of the verse. I reach the top floor, panting. A panatella turns to dust between his ochreous fingers. In the yard, pupils congregate like spawn. A group of first years debate the size of Barbara Streisand's breasts. I lie flat across the sill and bellow to my friend 4 floors below. Looking up, he cups his hands to his ears. Angelic and bald, our bottled fetus wallows in stasis as vowels and consonants fall like sediment. This next one is a very early one. For me, it was nearly 10 years old now. But I'm just fond of it. It's a sort of whodunit without a solution. I just wanted to write a poem as a sort of detective story, whereby there were clues laid as to who'd done the murder, but it was never actually solved. It's called Apogee of the Infamous Carnival Killer. Autumn, dusk. It's the end of the season, and punters are thin on the ground. Also thin on the hardened ground is Ginger, the elastic man, garrotted by the flex of a 2-pin plug. A detective constable chalks around the corpse. Distracted, he conjures up the fleshy contours of his wife. The freaks in the big top, hardly big, cry softly for Ginger, the bearded lady dabbing her button nose with a Kleenex, Samson consoling the fat lady. He cannot stretch his arm around her shoulders. She's crying buckets for her friend. And the bogus tattooed man dissolving shamelessly. Inside his cage, the man beast rattles the bars for show. Gentle as a leveret, he is above suspicion. While the freaks are swapping memories, alibis, and stunts for the following night, Ginger is stretchered away. Meters above him, the flying Zantini tumble into nothing. I maintain there's enough there to work out who done it, but I'm not telling you. Right, Maura and Lavinia will come among you, handing out bits of paper. While they're coming round, I'll explain a bit about them. I'm Welsh. I come from Swansea. And you will have gathered that from the accent straight away, but it's one of those relative things. Back in Swansea, they don't think I've got an accent, whereas you all do. And I think you've got accents as well, but that's neither here nor there. I hadn't been in Swansea for a while when I came back, and I was on a bus, and I could hear 2 girls talking. I was at the back and they were towards the front. And I could hear them talking, and I couldn't hear them well enough to hear what they were saying. All I could hear was the speech pattern. And I just wanted to capture the speech pattern. So what you've got in front of you are 2 phonetically written Swansea accents. The first one is called The Heart of Saturday Night. It's Vianelle. It's an Italian form where there are very few rhymes. I think it's two rhymes, I think. The most famous example, modern example, is Dylan Thomas's Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night, where he keeps repeating that line, and also Rage, Rage Against the Dying of the Light. He also comes from Swansea, by the way, so this is kind of a revenge on him as well. There's only one girl actually talking in the poem, but she's talking to her friend, saying what she and another friend had done on Saturday. The Heart of Saturday Night. This fair was on a common last Saturday. Dodgems, toffee apples, goldfish. Like I told, we went on a ghost train, mean Beverly. It's crap. And when she went home to have a tea, tried a waltzers. Brill, at a really old. This fair was on a common last Saturday. He's working a waltzers all night, wasn't he? This geezer Kev, I saw her. He's really old. We went on a ghost train, mean Beverly. When there was a wind blowing off a sea, is really nobbling. Jesus, course I's cold. This fair was on a common last Saturday. Common's fucking freezing. He's 23, Kev. White hands and a chain made out of gold. We went on a ghost train, mean Beverly. Kev had smack, white stuff. That's what he showed me on my life. Said he's gonna get it sold. This fair was on a common last Saturday. We went on a ghost train, mean Beverly. Yeah, right, this second one is called At the Foot of Division 4. It refers to Swansea City, who, when I wrote the poem in 87, were actually at the foot of Division 4. There was a time at the beginning of the 80s when they were in Division 1 and briefly at the top. It's explained in the poem, but what they really did was buy players that were at the end of their shelf life, play them, and they fought their way to the first division, lasted about a season, and then plunged straight back down to Division 4. So anyway, at the foot of Division 4. Our football team wears black and white. A yangs, a reds, a looks contrite for losing home and away. But still I'll go and watch them play in winter when the winds are blowing nine gales off a sea and throwing rubbish round the empty stands, blowing ice through my empty hands. John Toshak was a manager when he rose up to Division 1. And a side was full of codgers at the end of their careers. He bought them for peanuts and they played for a season. None of them stayed. And that was a long time ago. Now we back in Division 4. Perhaps it's a climate or a food in these parts does you so much good, I don't know. But the oldest lady in the British Isles lives by me in a gnome. Give or take a year of breathing salty Swansea air, she's in 109, and TV films her birthdays regularly. She's limp, tired, a vegetable. Her eyes are barely visible, receding in a red. Her skin's a dead, cracked riverbed, nothing swam above for ages. When a voice leaks through gaps in a shrunken face, she says, sod all to remember. Like postcards sent in December, nothing air but a scenery. Everything's old in this country. Grey hills, grey trees, and a post has been stuck on Neath Station forever. It's fluorescent and religious, with a question in big letters, and this question terrifies me. Where will you spend eternity? It's strange for me to hear this out loud as well, actually. Back to the dark. There's something incredibly impersonal about the underground. That's one source of this poem. The other source is if any of you have got an A to Z for any amount of time, you know the pages start to fall apart. It seems to be a characteristic of most people's A to Zs. They just start disintegrating. And those two images, basically the size of the underground and the amount of people that pass through it, that contrasted with a crumbling A to Z are what's behind this poem. The title refers to the Northern Line. It's called the Misery Line. The station they flock to is tucked among the peep shows. After work, the purblind crowds assemble, having failed by other means. God knows they've tried. Bins mounted on the walls, brim with tear-soaked paper tissues, and the stalls flog poison, rope, and pornographic magazines. Shiny-skinned, hung up like meat, The latest issues strain at their pegs when the wind blows from the station's mouth and the pavements tremble. The map on the wall downstairs is an opened body, all wires and veins. Snaking round the ticket hall, 12 deep, the men in suits clutch coins and farewell notes. Muzak trickles from the ceiling like flies, while slow, interminable exhalations sough through the station's many-chambered heart. Men close their eyes. Men tilt their heads to touch their throats. Men study their aches and pains, their shaving cuts. Men smooth their kipper ties. Pale, framed posters follow the steps down, flight by flight. Exaggerations, logos, lips, and the breathless pledge of hair today before those furbelows of rubbish fluttering on the edge of every escalator in the ugly light where arrows point towards a passageway that narrows. They march in time, the men, four deep, three deep, two deep, with one synonymous wish. Extinction, oblivion, bath night, sleep. Their shoulders buff the grey tiles white. Orations offering excuses wheeze through the station's dirty lungs, echo round the platform's vaulted ceiling. At last they reach it, the pride of the underground, marked with a plaque, the perfect suicide spot, where cleaners chosen for their lack of feeling work at night with spades and mops, hurriedly, before the pieces start to rot. Now the rush hour fills the platform. Footsteps pound, and the Muzak stops when, in a moment of frivolity, the speakers broadcast something not unlike a prayer, sonorous and, if only they could make the words out, wise. The men in suits have done with ropes and knives. Instead, they lean. And one man with his head buried in a crumbling A to Z sighs even as the southbound train arrives. Faces turn to face that rush of hard, warm air. Districts of the city burst from his palms like butterflies. Yeah, this next one's quite a short one. It's really about two things. One, a writing block. And two, the fact that my girlfriend, who's a teacher, would come home at the end of the day when I was between jobs, a nice way of putting it, unemployed. And I felt my only justification was to have written something in the day as a sort of balance to what she did in her day. There's a particularly unflattering simile in here, which I'll apologize for later. The poem is called Confetti. Dead leaves cross the threshold and the owner knows. Arriving in a red Mercedes frilled with rust an hour before the newlyweds, he cleans the hall, the stairs, flat three. I am keeping quiet while the Hoover snuffles around our door. There is little to show you this evening. A line, perhaps, that starts but doesn't finish, and my face white enough to scribble on. I am eating my biro, keeping quiet while transactions finish in the room above. Testy, tired from school, you'll crash in on this, my own gorillagram, kicking off your shoes, squatting on the sofa to cleanse your face with 10:06. When you litter the floor with buds of cotton wool, black from the dirt of your day. That poem has a start but no finish to it. By the way, I'm apologising now for gorillagram in public. My girlfriend is anything but like a gorillagram, but it just seemed a rather appropriate image for the bustle of the end of the day compared with my lack of activity. This next one is called In Case of Monsters. A fairly brief story behind it is that a friend of mine came to see the play I did about Dennis Nielsen and was so taken by the imagery of it that proceeded to tell me about his bedtime ritual when he was a child. You know, patterns in the curtains and all that. Well, he'd taken it one step further. And he used to go to bed with a knife under his pillow. And he was also convinced that the sound he could hear in his ear when he had his head on the pillow was not the thumping of his blood, his heartbeat, but was the sound of somebody coming up the stairs to get him. So what he'd done was count the number of steps in his house and then proceeded to count the heartbeats, hoping that they didn't stop because he'd then know that something was coming to get him and he'd have to go for the knife. So I wrote this list of instructions. In case of monsters. On the way to bed, A, take the staircase slowly. Note how many steps. Never race to the landing or try to chase shadows into corners. B, place books and comics under your bed. The Bible is still a safe bet. C, spread Sheffield knives 2 feet from your head. Polish them first. Ask Dad nicely, and he may sharpen them for you. D, always jump into bed. Monsters queue behind the valance until dew curdles on the garden. E, face the door before you go to sleep. Remain like that all night. Use string to keep yourself in place, then F, count sheep to save strain on the knots. NB, always have your bed well away from windows and let the room breathe all day, but never, never when the grey evenings give way to night. G, watch the pattern in your curtains change to things at sunset altogether strange. In the silence, they rearrange their disenfranchised smiles. When you hear your heartbeat on the pillow, H, count every thump, and if you don't know now the number of steps to go before your blood arrives, I, check the knives. Yes, finally, a poem about another part of the body. I just wanted to write a poem about a factory, and I decided in these consumerist times that it won't be long before you can buy your own eyeballs. So this one is called The Eyeball Works. Ad men bandy slogans like pupils guaranteed. The would-be donors queue all afternoon, while tinted windows of the eyeball works run cloud and passerby at half their normal speed. Into the evening, noises draw a crowd. Footsteps on a flight of marble stairs, murmurs from an unlit foyer, and the slow, self-satisfied give of drapery and armchairs laundered to the colour of the moon. Noses flatten on the glass like dough. Inside, the eyeball brochures packed in crates whiff unmistakably of money and success. They leave from the dock doors every night with details of bargains and sell-by dates. The workers, clothed in dust-revealing white, wear gloves that cling and oblong paper hats, each stamped with a happy eyebrows trademark. For safety's sake, they stand on rubber mats before their lightly greased machines to press, drill, gouge, and slice until it's dark. The marble benches are cobbled with eyes, arranged in rows, then opened like books. Eyes jostle in dishes. Eyes bob in jars, labelled according to status and size. Eyes for librarians and eyes of the stars anticipate one of those numerous tinges from palimpsest azure to Paul Newman blue, stored in carboys, doled out through syringes. Every jar is packed with long blank looks, and the needles are true. Tonight, security is a humming sound and the smell of disinfectant damp on floors. Tonight, the doorknobs are electrified and the ugly dog let loose in the compound pads down corridors like a bride. Small cameras on the ceilings wink and weave while, tapping the walls with his complimentary stick, the last of the donors to leave is leaving through the no admittance doors. He waves goodbye. The doors go tick, tick, tick. Thank you.